Electric bicycles are my jam. I'm turning into a nut for a good e-bike. It's easy to get around, we save gas not driving our car for short trips to the store, and I'm getting a little extra exercise. The folks at Velotric are sponsoring a series of videos on my channel to show off some affordable e-bikes and help people get up to speed. It's easier than you think, and prices have never been more competitive. You can catch those videos on my YouTube channel, but if you're interested in shopping an e-bike, head over to velotric.bike/somegadgetguy and look at their road bikes and fat tires. Again, VELOTRIC.BIKE/somegadgetguy. VELOTRIC.BIKE/somegadgetguy. If any of those bikes look good to you, you can save an additional $60 off an already low price by using the coupon code SOMEGADGET60, SOMEGADGET60 at checkout. Once again, VELOTRIC.BIKE/somegadgetguy and coupon code SOMEGADGET60, and I thank Velotric for being a sponsor on this show. I believe this means we are live. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, tech fans of all shapes and sorts and sizes and persuasions, welcome to another episode of the Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SGGQA podcast channel. I'm Juan Carlos Bagnell, a.k.a. Some Gadget Guy. That's the SGG of this terribly named podcast series. Jman150 already in the chat saying, remember to stay hydrated, everyone, with some water. So I will periodically douse myself in water throughout the course of this podcast. Hey, everybody, the name of this podcast is terrible, but the point of this podcast is always fun and why we like to hold our show on a Monday, get our week started off right, hang out with some great tech nerds, some really fun tech geeks, and follow up on news stories that keep evolving over time, especially with some of these trads. Trends and fads in social media. We've got a pretty heavy block of politics news, especially as we're looking at Facebook and Twitter and YouTube kind of melting down all around us. I just want to shout outs to everybody that's in the live chat right now as we kind of broach this Q&A. That's why we like doing this as an interactive show. Ownscon, Gormlord, Frank Gallo, Ron Guido, Pakistan, Grounded Tech, Lamprose, Random Hobby, Simon Says Hypno, Jojo the Techie, Bionic Scoop, Vince, Cup of Cash, Al Sabakli, did I say Random Hobby, 2 Turbo, and Dave Burns just popped in to say hey, and that he's maybe going to show up a little bit later. Trads! That's the new theme of our show, trends and fads, so that we can talk about all the tech trads that are happening all around us. So bad. Oh, man. So, yes, we've got a lot to dig into, a lot to sort of noodle around with and chew on this week. I want to start off like we do every week. I hope everyone had a lovely weekend. We had some family in town. And as part of housekeeping, I'll talk a little bit more about what we did over the weekend. But I'm sure for most school districts out there, if you have kids, you're probably starting off your summer break or looking at summer camps. We've got Lex kind of scheduled on a pretty active calendar for a 7-year-old. She's got a significantly more active social life than Marie and I do. So we're going to be working a part-time job just to keep her cranking on all of her social activities. Grounded Tech says, you're a treader, Juan, a trend setter. With my trads? Yeah. Oh, man. I'm already feeling like it's going to be one of those shows, folks, because, like I said, we've got some cranky news, some interesting news, and some fun news. But Ari came in kind of mushmouth, so we'll see how this goes. I had to give myself a serious break, though, from the end of last week to, through the weekend. I wasn't full-on miming, but I was partially mute just from all the extra talking. I don't know if y'all know this, but if you really want to do a long-form, essay, well-produced podcast, it is it's almost as much work as doing, like, a video. So I'm trying to like source sound clips and I'm looking at music and I'm trying to put together this really long supplemental podcast. And you're like, man, this is exhausting. And it was a lot of extra talking. So why don't we, what are we, 9:04 in the a.m. I'm just going to try and get through some housekeeping here, because housekeeping has a couple extra little tangents on it that are going to sort of, we're going to talk about some of the stuff that's going on. So some of our housekeeping is some of our news. Here, let me get this out of the way. I just want to screen share now. Here. So, starting us off, one of the main videos that I put out last week, we finally finished up this sponsored video. The company 70Mai sponsored this conversation about upgrading the technology of your car with some new little dash cams that they've got coming out. And they're pretty pretty handy little tech upgrades for people who have older cars like our family does. And it's not just can you record what's happening in front of you and behind you, but also can you add some basic driver assistance? So not only GPS, but also basic lane guidance and collision avoidance. So that was a fun little project to put together. It took us a while to kind of finish that video up, so I'm glad that that video is finally out. Then, after a whole slate of really awful ear infections, I'm trying to keep up with some more audio reviews. And so the folks at Status Audio sent over the Between 3 ANC True Wireless Earbuds with a really unique driver design. So this is something we don't see very often in True Wireless. And just again, a very unique kind of sound. So I did a full review on those bad boys. That was kind of fun. And then the really fun and exciting new addition to the Gadget Lab. I ordered this on day one. I put in an order as soon, the instant, like literally the minute I could get a link to purchase this. So alongside my Xiaomi 13 Ultra, Xiaomi also sells this really trick little photography kit. And so I did a full unboxing looking at this photography kit. And we're going to push pause on the sort of normal slate of me just reading off what's on somegadgetguy.com, because I have the photography kit. And I've been using it super, super heavy. So this is my Xiaomi 13 Ultra. And you can see it now has a much larger lump on the back. Because on this, I currently, it's just a little UV filter. Let me tell you, the mega camera phones, like my Xiaomi 12S Ultra, my Vivo X90, and I'm sure some folks out there who were maybe on older Samsung Ultras can attest to this too. Having a giant slab of glass on the back of your phone is really concerning. Like your Note 20 Ultras, they take a hit and that back glass can just explode. Your Xiaomi 12S Ultras, even your Xiaomi 13, like the Xiaomi 13 Pro, I think is kind of built in a similar fashion where there's this big lump of glass on the back. So even before you get into lens filters that can augment your photo capabilities, I just have a UV filter on the back here. And it's so nice having, like, the protection peace of mind of, like, I drop my Xiaomi 13 Ultra and it lands camera side down, all I'm going to do is crack, like, an $8 piece of glass. I'm not going to completely wreck all of the cameras on the back of the phone. And then it's just a standard 67 millimeter filter thread. Do a little ASMR for you here. I'm sure that doesn't sound awful in your ears. Apologies to headphone listeners right now. You just get another one, you put it on, and you're back to protecting your phone again. And going even a step sillier, to protect the lens filter, I have just a cheap generic 67 millimeter lens cap. So I'm walking around the Santa Barbara Zoo. We've got some family in town, grandparents visiting Lex, and I'm walking around with this phone, and I'm taking photos and stuff, and someone actually does come up to me like, hey, is that a phone or is that a camera? What is that you just took that photo of? And I had that really beautiful geek tech moment where someone comes over and he's like, oh, yeah, that looks crazy. And like I start telling them all about it, and you're like, oh, and look, I've got UV filters, and I've got neutral density filters, and a circular polarizer. And guy kept asking me questions about it. It wasn't so much like someone was like, hey, what's the camera? And then like I rambled and then they got bored and walked away. It was another dad just like, you've got to tell me all about what that thing is because I've never seen anything like it. And I think I can show you. Hold on. That this was the, here, I'm just going to do an entire screen share. That'll probably be easier. And screen share this. And can I just make that bigger? No, I really can't. We don't want that. That's lame. I got to scroll down and find it now. So, this is, the snow leopard enclosure in the shade. And, I've got, filters and everything. I had the camera grip on it too. And I get this photo and I'm just kind of holding it up and I'm letting Lex take a look at it. And that's when the other dad came over and was like, what did you just take that photo on? And I got to tell him all about the company Xiaomi. And he was like, oh, but I mean, like, are those cameras like iPhone cameras or is it more like a Samsung? And he was like, what I just took the photo on here is probably a year ahead of anything that we have in the United States. Maybe two, depending on what we get next year. And he was like, oh, man, how does it all work? And can you buy the phone? Can you get it here? So it was a really sweet moment. We like those kinds of let me show off for a second kinds of geek braggery kinds of things. So that was really fun. But yeah, shot the entire Santa Barbara Zoo with filters and polarizers, and it was just a really really good time. It was a really really fun time. Here, you know, let me see it because I think I also have a good. I know this is terrible for the audio listeners, but got a flamingo, and I thought that shot came out pretty well. That snow leopard came out really well. The ISO was really cranked because I had an ND filter, so I was already a stop down. But even for it being kind of noisy, it still came out pretty good. I saw someone watering a cockatoo, so you want to see a cockatoo get kind of sprayed down. There's kind of a fun photo right there. And I want to get this other one. I got a really good close up on a vulture. Ah, here we go. So this is from one of the telephoto sensors and just came out phenomenal. Like I can see the patterns in the iris of the vulture's eye. So, you know, streaming the 720p in a reduced window is probably not great. And I know how everybody loves looking at vacation photos from people. But yeah, we had a really good time in Santa Barbara. I gotta say, the Xiaomi photography kit is already coming in clutch. This thing is fantastic. It is everything that I had always hoped a manufacturer would put out. It drives me nuts that, because I've been begging for this since the Sony Xperia 1 Mark 1, is to put out a case that just has a standard camera filter thread on the back and so that we can put on filters. And tonight, I'm going to take the Xiaomi out to one of my favorite freeway overpasses and see if I can really get a good, like, 30-second long exposure of, like, streaking taillights, especially with the aperture. So if I can stop it down to f4 and throw on some ND filters and get that, like, 30-second taillight streak and see if I can really sharpen that all up, because I think that'll look real, real good. So, yeah. So, Aditya Nil saying, look at that natural bokeh from a phone. And that was one of the telephoto sensors too. So it's even a little bit of a smaller sensor and it still looks real good. Oh, thanks, Brian says that the, pictures of the vulture are top tier. cup of cash, brag on, Juan, brag on. It's the most fun that you can have as a gadget reviewer when you're walking around and something really does catch a person's eye. And I still go back holding up examples of like the Honor 8. The Honor 8 I still think holds the record for phone that most people ask me about, even if most people were asking what case I had on my iPhone. But people just I'd be doing something in line at the grocery store, and the woman at the register would ask me about the phone. I'd be like taking a call, and someone would like kind of stop and like point at my phone until I was done with my call. Like, people wanted to know about that, and I just don't feel like we've kind of maintained that kind of curiosity. I think a lot of people look at what's going on right now, and they're sort of acclimated, like, yeah, it's an iPhone or it's a Samsung or whatever, and then every now and then, you can still catch someone's eye, and something is unique, and it looks like a camera, but it looks like a phone. What did you do there? And then you get to have a really fun conversation. And if it's person by person, then I guess that's how we win back some enthusiasts, because it's a lot more fun that way. It really is. So the other bit of housekeeping that I wanted us to talk about just a little bit here, I'm going to screen share again, if I can get back to, there we go. Early last week, was it 6 days ago, I'm sitting in my dining room, and someone on the Discord, and I really apologize, someone on the Discord clued me in that this was going down live, and now I have completely spaced who did that to properly credit who told me about this. But I'm sitting in my dining room, and usually I catch All About Android on the replay. It's a show I really like to have on as audio. I'm not usually trying to watch it live. But this week, the crew, all of my pals at All About Android, signed off for the very last time after 635 episodes. They recorded their final episode. They did a whole roundup on sort of an Android Hall of Fame of devices and some of their stats over the years and their favorite apps. They brought back Flo Ion just to kind of sit in the chair and to chat with Ron and Jason. And I got really emotional about it. This is a show that, even if I'm not listening, I've had on almost every single episode since I started listening to it years ago. I can't tell you the incredible number of imaginary conversations and fake debates that I've had in my head with the hosts on All About Android, and just how grateful I am that they let me, as the cranky geek, guest from time to time to share some you know, ideas that aren't necessarily sort of the mainstream tech. They would have me on, and they'd let me kind of ramble out some of my frustrations, or also just take like kind of a side view on why I think certain moves were not represented well in the tech industry. They literally like had me on 1 week just to talk about sort of a bias in reporting based on how content is monetized. And I, you know, again, for such a fun production, it was, I keep coming back to a word like grateful, because I got to go sit at the fun lunch table for a minute. And I always loved the production of their show and the vibe of the hosts. And, you know, they tackle some heavy news, but, you know, it was always with a sort of a very fun presentation to how they got their show done. And I went back through their archives. Like, I did 14 episodes of All About Android. Each one of those is kind of an incredible memory all on its own. And I can't tell you how surreal it would be, even today. I was in their third to last show, you know, from closing down on episode 635. If you go back to episode 632, there I am. Even to this day, I started listening to Ron on the earliest days of iFanboy, you know, like, it was so crazy being on the call or in the live stream and thinking, you know, like, oh, but Jason, if you do this, blah, 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 blah. And then Jason would reply to me. Because that's usually not how podcasts work. It's usually I think something in my brain while I'm driving my car, and the podcast hosts just keep talking about whatever else they're talking about. But that's like the imaginary part of the debate. And then you would hear Jason's voice reply to me, and it'd be like, oh, crap, I'm in this moment. I'm in this moment right now, and I love this show. So this kind of reinforces a number of those conversations that we've been having recently. There were another slate of major YouTube channels putting out videos talking about burnout, creators who are walking away from regular production, if not leaving YouTube entirely. Scaling all the way up to someone like a PewDiePie, who is talking more publicly talking about the impact that this kind of content production has on their life, and realizing how difficult the landscape has become over the last couple of years to keep up production, keep standards high. Because there's a gulf of difference between a show like All About Android and my podcast. And I'd say that there's a pretty sizable gap between my podcast and some of the other enthusiast publications that are putting out podcasts. And I mean, just in terms of content and production quality and consistency and how we source our material and how we put it all together and how many people are working on it to provide this content on the regular. And it kind of just keeps going hand in hand with that conversation. We've lost so many great tech commentators over the last couple years, people who have just walked away, and all of that expertise leaves with them. And we haven't found people really replenishing their ranks. I'll point it back to, you know, someone who I respect and admire greatly, is like an Erica Griffin. Where is the next Erica? Because her production schedule has tapered off significantly, and I think she's sort of lost her taste for how she handled topics and her place in the YouTube landscape and the reaction she got from viewers. I relied on her commentary heavily for sort of understanding what I was experiencing on my phones and tablets and laptops, and getting to work with her on doing like an old phone challenge was an absolute joy, only to then see like, oh, people kind of liked it. I mean, this was cool or whatever. And you're like, you don't understand how much behind the scenes work it took to get a bunch of YouTubers together to coordinate and collaborate on a series of videos to make that. And if we had found any kind of traction, then that would have been a feature you would have seen on the regular. And it would have been a lot more fun just seeing people kind of bounce off of each other and work together. But to watch all of that labor then just sort of crash and burn, that was really disheartening. So we're at this point right now where now larger Web 2.0 experiments like the Twit network are struggling to maintain their monetization. What was the other show? Ant's show also just signed off too. Can someone please remind me? Ant's photography show on the Twit network. I was a more casual listener of his show because there was a lot of like photography analysis, which I don't think really plays out for audio. So even when, I was subscribed on YouTube, but that's a show that I would like kind of have on in the background, and then occasionally like look over at the screen to see like, well, what is he talking about? Hands-on photography. Ah, a DTNL. Thank you. And watching Ant sign off was kind of a punch in the gut too, for just his plea for supporting content creators, and then also just to remind his audience of what we're all supposed to be there for, what we're all supposed to care about, have fun taking photos. We're sliding on this stuff, and I don't know where we stop. I don't know where this all ends up. It feels like the crazy experimental exploration of building communities and hosting discussions is under direct threat on the regular. Especially when we see the machinations of executives at all these social media platforms trying to extract as much value per screen on time minute that they can generate from not only the people consuming content, but also creating it, and how all of these creators are basically under constant churn. Like, if I take time off, my YouTube stats plummet. If I put out a slightly less popular video, my YouTube stats plummet. And it's, I can't say much more than that, because it's also kind of against the creator terms of service to really share the granular information about how much trouble I've had in maintaining a YouTube channel. And publicly, what does that look like? It looks like one of the last great high concept, high production value Android enthusiast podcasts is now gone. And that just further reinforces to communities out there that you can't make money on Android. Android is not an exciting topic. Consumers don't care. You're not growing your ranks. You're not building a new audience. You basically just should just roll over and everyone should get iPhones. And I feel like that's, unfortunately, the lesson that many are going to take from these types of situations falling apart. So, I mean, there are still a couple shows out there. What's the 9 to 5 Google has a Google-focused show. It's not Android specifically, but it's something Alphabet. So focusing on all the sort of products of Google. There's the Material podcast. They're still putting out a show. But we don't really have the same kind of, like, consumer enthusiast platform, right? Because, like, you look at iPhone stuff across social media, and there's, like, a hardcore group of developers. They're talking about iOS and iPadOS. But then there's a ton of lifestyle stuff. And we don't have that for Android. There's, like, this huge gap in the middle. You've got a ton of people talking about, like, FOSS and Linux and developer stuff. And then maybe you get some token efforts at really low-level basic, oh, this is how you toggle your developer settings. I've seen, like, 3 or 4 of those videos as shorts out over the last month. And you're like, I don't know how many videos we really need of people saying, find your build number and tap on it until it says you are now a developer. That's like the constant churn of just like, I need to put out a video on something. I guess I'll make it on that. So this turned into a little bit more of a rambling rant than I intended to. The main focus and the main point, I absolutely believe that all the hosts on All About Android and the hosts that had been with the show and left the show and gone on to do other things, I know they're going to go on and do cool work, but I can't shake this feeling that we lost something really unique, and I don't think we can get it back. I don't think it can return. I don't think two guys just sort of talking on mics in a bedroom are going to replace the studio-driven, multi-camera, beautifully produced bumpers and ads and high production value conversation that that we had with All About Android. It's hard to really describe why that was so special and why it represented something important to an enthusiast community. But now that it's gone, I think now we'll have a lot of people recognizing that we did lose something special and maybe we should have supported it. Oh, well, I guess we'll just go on and everyone under the age of 20 is already only buying iPhones. So I know all of those hosts are going to go on to do great work. I am so grateful to have not only just like kind of interacted with them, but like have real conversations and sort of behind the scenes, social media, friendships in the DMs, regularly just poking in and just saying, hey, you know, I hope you're doing well. That kind of work relationship, that kind of work friendship is, it means a lot to me because you often feel like this endeavor is a really lonely or solo kind of endeavor. And it takes a little bit of effort to remember that, like, you know, there are real people on the other side of this that are a part of this and that like to hang out. So I just wanted to say kind of an extra little piece here at the beginning of the podcast to say goodbye to All About Android. You can catch my blog post where I was writing it in the moment of discovering that this was going to be the last show. And my blog post reads as the sort of momentary ramblings of someone who's emotionally upset. But the farther I've gotten away from their last episode, the more I've just like, it's just resonating more like, oh, this really sucks. We lost something good here. So, we should probably move on. All of the stories, all of the links, everything that we're going to be talking about for this week's show can be found on the show notes, on my blog, and on the audio podcast page for this show. But you can catch this on somegadgetguide.com. Hopefully you're subscribing and supporting and sharing with people who are like-minded and tech nerds like we are. Anderspand is saying, I'm missing, you know, all about Android. Brian Glaze, I agree with that one. We are missing that middle content. That's what we had. And now I feel like people have kind of shrugged it off. I feel like people are acting like this is all done and we're just kind of coasting on the momentum of what was fun and exciting and competitive before. Where again, I mean, like, I've got a desk full of really crazy exotic phones here where some dude at the zoo just stopped to ask about my Xiaomi and I have to tell him, like, oh, and it's not something you can buy here. That's great. I'm gonna take a little drink of coffee here and then we're gonna jump into why Facebook is melting down in Canada. That'll be fun.
Hey folks, are you getting bored of the current collection of tech and geek commentary on the internet? Is the discussion of new electronics feeling a bit stale? Do you want to find some fresh voices to add to your subscription queue? Check out the community on r glowing rectangles on Reddit. Now, this subreddit was built to help new voices in the tech community find more audience, and we need your support. Sharing, commenting, and those precious, tasty upvotes. Reddit can radically help a content creator expand their reach. Do you know a producer who deserves more attention? Do you just want to find fun new stuff? Head on over to reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles and share or browse to your heart's content. Once again, reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles, and let's build something cool together.
Okay, I'm going to go straight into a screen share as we hit the news block. You know, again, because I don't have, like, bumpers and tags. I don't have a producer who can handle this for me. I'm not making enough money to employ someone that can, on the weekly, go, doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo. I guess that's my bumper for news. That terrible, like, not Morse code beeping sound. Because here we go. Facebook to end news access in Canada over incoming law on paying publishers. This is direct from the Reuters feed by Ismail Shakil and David Lundgren. I have mispronounced both of your names, I am sure. I apologize. From the article, the legislation known as the Online News Act was approved by the Senate upper chamber earlier on Thursday and will become law after receiving royal assent from the Governor General, which is a formality. The legislation was proposed after complaints from Canada's media industry, which wants tighter regulation of tech companies to prevent them from elbowing news businesses out of the online advertising market. Quote, today we are confirming that news availability will be ended on Facebook and Instagram for all users in Canada prior to the Online News Act taking effect, Meta said in a statement. So, I like the general application of this as pressure. I feel Facebook's news relationships have largely been built on a bait and switch. These are my feelings. I am not making a legal claim that there is definitely a dishonest business tactic. But when I look at the trends of how Facebook interacts with brand pages, I find it is, I have a feeling that this is close to a form of digital extortion. Facebook sells advertising. Newspapers used to sell advertising, but to reach users early on in Facebook's sort of rise as a popular platform, news agencies would make these brand pages. They would get all of these amazing metrics and all of this incredible data from Facebook. A lot of that turned out to be sort of nebulously calculated. Like, not really a huge benefit to the organizations, but it was keeping a lot of eyeballs on Facebook. So Facebook was benefiting from that. Later, Facebook found that they could ratchet payments to their platform by extorting, my feelings, not a legal definition of extortion, they could go to the brand page manager and say, well, your last post only reached 5% of all of the people who are following your brand page. So if you want to reach the rest of your followers, the people who said they want to see your content, all you have to do is pay us more. And that to me is the fatal flaw in Facebook's business model from the legal side of this, where if the boosting of Facebook content was sent out to reach new readership, I don't know that they'd be facing the same kind of issues that they are facing in Canada. Instead, they ratcheted down on the people creating the content, which creates the value in using Facebook as some kind of aggregating social media service, and they tried to squeeze more money out of those people while also monetizing everybody's user and behavior data. So they wanted, like, triple dipping. So you're going to work for free to make Facebook more valuable and provide it with more content. You're going to build up an audience, which we're monetizing all of your audience's behavior, and we're monetizing your brand behavior. And then you should pay us to reach the people who said they already wanted to follow you. And that's been a problem early on. When we started producing the movie review show back in like 2008, we had this like quick little bump of really exciting traffic from Facebook on our content. And then it very quickly flipped into, oh, I mean, you've got like 1,000 followers on your brand page. You only reached 10 people. Don't you want to reach more? You know, go into your Facebook settings and give us a credit card, and then you can boost your posts. And we tried it, and we saw almost zero benefit from not only people that said that they were following our Facebook page. Our content wouldn't go out to other movie fans. We weren't bringing anyone new. But they would give us these stats like, oh, and you reached like 600 new viewers. Look at all these eyeballs your content's getting. And you're like, yeah, that's all crap, because we can literally see watch times and downloads and everything else that would have contributed to us like building our show audience. We got nothing. We spent a couple $100 to get nothing. And again, we had a production team of 3 people and we were doing the show for free. And I think over 3 years of production, we only had a handful of sponsors ever work with us on that show. So I'm for this. I feel like the actual application of this is really clumsy, but this is a first step in a government taking this conversation seriously and pushing back against what I feel is a horrifically anti-business trend from social media. And it's going to take some work. I mean, this now needs to be refined. I believe Australia was the first to pass a similar style of law. Canada is a big market to also adopt a strategy like this. And we need to re-examine the relationships that aggregating services have with their audience and with the people who provide content. This lines immediately up with the drama that we've been watching unfold at Reddit, where the Reddit executives are acting like all of the readers and the moderators are just these horrible, whiny, lazy freeloaders. But at the same time, it's the readers and the moderators who provide all the value of a platform like Reddit. And they're trying to say, oh, but it's just the small number of users who are using these third-party apps, and they're not monetized, and that's a problem. And you want to say, but your entire platform exists from free labor. So then let them use the tools that deliver the content for the vast majority of the readers that you say you really care about, or revenue share. Like, as much as I have massive problems with YouTube and the way that YouTube is run these days, I'm not making much money on YouTube, but for the few videos they actually send out to my subscribers, I do get a cut of the ad revenue, I guess. There's no reason why Reddit couldn't be built along a similar platform, except for the fact that Reddit executives are terrible at monetizing a social news site. So this is like another little link in a chain, and I hope that we see continued pressure, continued efforts, because the social part of social media is getting wrecked to try and monetize the momentum of websites that we act like they're institutions, and they're not institutions. Facebook is a blip on the evolutionary timeline of media and entertainment and news. And you know, they can fall apart pretty quick. You know, there's nothing to suggest that an aggregating, let me message people I know kind of site is in any way special. So, I hope we see a bit more of this. Simon says hypno. Again, I am purposely not talking about the Elon Musk versus Mark Zuckerberg fight. Apparently they're going to do, what is it, an MMA match or something like that? How hilarious is it that we've seen all of the drama and news? We've got a story about Twitter in here coming up next, and all of the fallout and all of the awful sort of like outlooks and Facebook. And you're like, oh, well, what would absorb more headlines and distract people from the real terrible news of how much everyone hates our platforms now? I know. No one likes Mark Zuckerberg, and more people are finding Elon Musk's behavior distasteful. What if they punched each other in the face a whole bunch? Wouldn't that be so funny if a bunch of tech billionaires just started, like, kicking each other? I'd totally tune in for that. And again, it's all to distract you. Nothing about that is really entertaining in the slightest. There's no Schadenfreude. We know they're probably gonna make a ton of money. I mean, as like a fight promoter, if this is going through like traditional MMA fight promotion, then whoever is building this fight is gonna make out like a bandit. And a bunch of people are gonna be like so self-satisfied, like, my least favorite tech billionaire got punched in the face and the other tech billionaire did better. And you're like, no, Facebook has been almost defrauding every single news agency that you might care about for doing good work and good journalism and bringing you relevant information for well over a decade. And I don't care if Mark Zuckerberg gets punched in the face. I care that Facebook is taken to task for almost mafia style. My feelings, not by the legal definition of this type of business practice that harms all of the people that actually make the content that I care about and that I want to see. So we should probably shift gears. I'm not going to spend as much time on this because I feel like this is just, again, it's another little step that we see in a behavior of governments, how they're reacting to social media platforms. That this one comes by way of BBC News. Peter Hoskins on the business beat. Elon Musk, Australia threatens to fine Twitter over online hate. From the article, the country's online safety commissioner says Twitter has become the most complained about platform. Twitter has been 28 days to... I don't understand how that sentence is phrased. Twitter has been 28 days to respond to the regulator or face potential fines of hundreds of thousands of dollars. I think Ben is incorrect. Twitter has 28 days to respond to the regulator or face potential fines of hundreds of thousands of dollars. Now, that doesn't sound like much, but what we're talking about, the company has been told to respond to the watchdog within 28 days or face penalties of up to 700,000 Australian dollars per day for continuing these breaches. We are also aware of reports that the reinstatement of some of these previously banned accounts has emboldened extreme polarizers, peddlers of outrage and hate, including neo-Nazis, both in Australia and overseas. So again, we've been trying to build this loose network of how do we police content, and that makes me very anxious when governments get involved in the conversation about policing content. The best solution is platforms policing their own content. We saw that when I was a kid, I got to see it firsthand with the music industry. Oh no, these rap lyrics are starting to show up in suburban white kid households. What will we do? Parents are terrified. The outrage. I'm clutching my pearls. And the music industry responded by putting explicit lyric stickers so that parents could be better informed. The bad solution would have been the music industry pushing back against doing anything, and then the government coming in to say, you can't make this media. That's the bad solution. We don't want to get to the point where the government actually has some kind of say over the content that's being distributed. We saw it with the Comics Code Authority. We saw that with the movie industry. I still feel the video game industry needs a swift kick up the head that video game ratings do not apply to monetization. I love that you can pick up a video game, look at the rating, and say, okay, well, there's gory content. This is for teenagers or above. Awesome. That is a great step. We want to make sure parents know this is a game not intended for children by way of its content and storytelling and graphics. Cool. But we also need to factor in, does this game feature gambling mechanics? Because kids can't go into a Las Vegas casino and pump quarters into a slot machine. We as a society have said, we think this type of neurostimulus, this kind of dopamine delivery hit, is bad for children, and only adults should be allowed to engage with that. I don't care if it's directly associated with a monetization of prize and winnings. I only care that that mechanic is built into games. And that should also factor into the rating system of video games. And if it doesn't, then I kind of would support a government agency coming in to say, no, you can't have that kind of monetization in a video game that kids might play. Sorry. I feel real strong about that. So the only thing that bothers me is, like, we just saw recently from the EU, Twitter is facing scrutiny over there. Now we're seeing Twitter face scrutiny in Australia. And the whole mission used to be Twitter would police itself. Twitter is not policing itself more. Twitter is engaging in as much controversy to get eyeballs on the site with outlandish and outrageous posts from people that were previously deplatformed. It is a private company, it's a private institution, but at some point, it is a part of a government's best interest to combat the spread of misinformation, disinformation, especially in a very hostile landscape like we face today, where you can weaponize this spread. You can create pockets of extreme dissent that then eventually rise into doing terrible, terrible things. At the beginning of the pandemic, watching people in the UK torch 5G cell towers, all through the spread, the weaponized disinformation of other regions around the world, targeting vulnerable, ignorant people in the UK. The UK government should have an interest in not watching their infrastructure get torched and burned to the ground. If Twitter can't fix that problem, then Twitter needs to not exist. Then Twitter needs to be fined and sort of regulated into oblivion. If Twitter can't fix it on their own, then it needs to be shown as a failed business model so that other social media networks will look at that failure and say, hey, I'd really rather our site that we've invested tons of investor cash into and built this community, I'd really prefer that not happen to us either. So let's not do that. Let's at least make a token effort. And this is what's sad, is it's like the lowest level, bare minimum. You know, what this person posted isn't true. or what this person regularly posts is hateful. No one is engaging with them in a sort of an earnest or in a healthy fashion. At some point you say, nah. We don't need to extend a platform on a private institution servers for that person to have speech. They can make their own speech platform, and they can deal with the ramifications of international governments and regulators. We don't have to facilitate that on our platform, and it's really messy. This is a very complicated problem. I very much appreciate the perspective of free speech absolutists, but I also have to stand by the protections afforded from court cases on compelled speech as well. And I don't feel a lot of these social media platforms are doing a very good job. And I feel a number of them have walked back. Is last week or the week before we talked about YouTube is no longer going to combat election fraud misinformation right before we start campaigning for another election. How convenient. More controversy will be more clicks and eyeballs on YouTube. I can't wait for a bunch of horrifically misinformed people to go into the voting booth and make their voices heard based on information which is crazy, crazy incorrect. It's going to warm my heart to see the outcome of one of the most divisive eras of politics get ratcheted so that YouTube can generate more ad revenue and the line can go up a little bit more for Google and Alphabet shareholders. I love it. It's going to be great. Yeah, Gormlord, but that would lose them so much money. Think of the CEOs, Juan. We need a massive course correct on how we monetize social media. It was never sustainable, but now it's legit broken. It's so bad. I'm going to take another drink of coffee here. Then we're going to talk about something else. Oh, Simon says, Hypno, I wish so bad. Twitter will be saved when Dave Grohl pops up in a surprise takeover. How much fun would it be if, like, some old school rocker like Dave Grohl was just like, you know what? Let's try it. You know, Ryan Reynolds owned a cell phone MVNO. I could buy Twitter. Well, how much could Twitter possibly cost now that Elon Musk has been running it? It's like an Arrested Development joke. Like, how much can a banana really cost? Here's another one that we really need to keep an eye on. And if you are like-minded like me, I am already drafting a letter that I am going to send to the FCC, voicing my displeasure over this. I would appreciate like-minded individuals not taking their ire to social media where politicians will be able to comfortably ignore constituents, but of calling or in emailing or in sending messages. Maybe you write a letter and they actually have to open the letter and read it. I don't know what your preferred method of communication might be. It's coming by way of Ars Technica, my nerdy telecom reporting man crush on John Brodkin. ISPs say U.S. should force big tech firms to pay for broadband construction. U.S. telecoms pitch shared obligation for tech firms to fund network buildouts. Internet service providers in both the U.S. and Europe are clamoring for new payments from big tech firms. European broadband providers are much closer to realizing the long-held goal of payments from tech companies, as EU government is holding an official consultation on the proposal. As the EU process unfolds, the telco lobby group US Telecom is hoping to push the US down a similar but not quite identical path. I'm not going to read all of John Brodkin's article because I would prefer you just read it yourself. I'm going to reiterate a history here in the United States of we were promised fiber to home years and years ago. We have been paying fees on broadband bills. We have been giving broadband providers special sweetheart deals for zoning and for pole access and for zoning concerns and digging trenches. And the vast majority of Americans still have no clear competition in the broadband space. But every couple of years, we see all of the broadband ISPs, all of the service providers go hat in hand to the federal government asking for billions more dollars. There is another initiative that is currently working through the FCC to fund more broadband deployment. When we don't have accurate maps on broadband deployment, but all of the companies as a part of this program are going to get billions of dollars. We've seen this happen time and time and time again. We have funded this notion of better broadband to Americans several times over. And if we would just roll the fiber, then we'd be able to reach those harder hit communities that are less profitable. At some point, so much money has gone into all of this from taxpayers, and so little has come back to the people that are paying for it, that are really paying for it, that I feel we need to have those stark conversations about who owns the internet. Because every time I look up the quarterlies at AT&T and Verizon and Comcast and Spectrum, I see lots of profits. I see stock buybacks. I see billions of dollars going into shareholder value. And I don't see any faster upload speeds in my neighborhood. I can sometimes squeeze slightly faster download speeds, but most of the time that's just up to. You know, my peak download speed can get a little bit faster, My sustained download speed does not change. So I am very displeased. And now, while they're still getting billions of additional taxpayer dollars for funding broadband deployment in rural areas, they're now trying to squeeze, yet again, the companies that work on the internet. And this sounds, on its surface level, to me, it sounds like a good argument. Well, Google and YouTube uses up so much bandwidth. They should have to pay their fair share. But they do. YouTube is a customer on the internet, accessing the pipes. Google builds these data centers to house videos and to distribute that content. Ditto Netflix, ditto Max, whatever HBO wants to call Hulu, all of these services, they're also customers. And they pay not only sort of a direct fee, but the interconnect fees because they are backbone services on the internet. So they're paying their own data center costs. They're paying for their own interconnect fees. We saw these debates play out viciously between Netflix and Verizon. And Netflix would try to say, hey, if your Netflix stream is buffering or slowing down, we can see that the choke point is Verizon. And then Verizon threatened to sue them into oblivion. So Netflix couldn't even tell their customers what the real problem was when Netflix started streaming video. So these major internet services are already paying to be on the internet. The ISPs are pushing for them to pay more. And this is where we really, again, if you're pro-business in the United States and you don't think net neutrality is a good idea, this is why I think you're kind of dumb. Because if you're pro-business, then you want that competitive aspect of people being able to operate on the internet free of ISPs dictating how much that involvement should cost. So someone's using more internets, we need to charge them more per the internets they're already using. That's not how a fair marketplace should be handled. The ISPs are handling all the pipes. However, whatever bad metaphor we want to use to describe this business practice, we need to push back. This is a terrible idea. This is punitively attacking successful companies on the internet. And the ISPs have never delivered on their promises of improving this for end users. And all they're looking to do is extract more value and more wealth and make line go up a little bit more for a couple of fiscal quarters. But it's going to have a disastrous consequence on new companies and startups that might make a popular service. And then their internet bills are going to slide with the popularity of their service. We should not be allowing that. Please read this entire article from John Brodkin. He just does such a fantastic work because it's also well linked and well cited and well sourced. So there are other links that you kind of click through to see that, like, this is a conversation that we've been having for like 30 years when the internet was just this first like loose collection of nodes that was sort of an add-on to your phone bill to then becoming an add-on to your cable bill, and how it's all built around this sort of conspicuous consumption of media. And we're still talking about it as if it's the wacky little thing you watch cat videos on, and we're ignoring that this is like a vital lifeblood service to education, to medicine, to entertainment. I mean, that's fair too. And then just for so many of our social interactions, we're trying to make this more equitable, but plans like this will have a humongous chilling effect on innovation in this space. It's so, so disappointing. From Kappa Cash, if they force big tech to pay more, they will simply pass it on to consumers. I mean, that is definitely a concern too. It would be interesting because, like, you know, Alphabet's business model is heavily entrenched in advertising. So they pass it on to their customers, who are the companies that advertise through Alphabet services. Then those companies will find ways of passing costs onto end users like us. I mean, I think that's the other thing that's kind of messed up is I am not the customer at Google. Google doesn't care about me as a source of revenue. They care about me as a source of churn. I am providing content that then they can monetize, and their real customers, the customers they care about, are the companies that are actually giving them money to serve ads on these various platforms. So the wide-ranging effects of plans like this will be felt in a very multifaceted way. Sami says, no, I mean, we kind of are. Taxpayers should just pay for all infrastructure that businesses require. Why should companies pay for their business costs with their entitled profits? Stupid peons. We kind of do, though. You know, like, we did sort of pay for all of the rollout. And you look at all the fees and look at all the taxes and look at everything that's gone into, like, our broadband infrastructure. And Ode Mouse, I'm sorry, I don't know how you pronounce your name. The FCC has not done its job. I currently live in an area where Optimum has a complete lock on my area and no competition is allowed. And especially after the Trump administration, that was by design. Ajit Pai came in, rolled back all of our net neutrality protections that took us a decade to get. Before we'd even really had the momentum of net neutrality in place, he gutted all of that. And then just sort of left it up to the ISPs to self-report on their broadband practices, their data acquisition, how ISPs basically monetize all of your traffic. Everything you do on the internet through your home broadband connection is siphoned off, is analyzed, and can basically be sold to the highest bidder. The FTC published a very hard-hitting report on how invasive and how dangerous all of that data tracking is from the companies that manage the pipes. So you're monetizing your behavior like that too. And then Ajit Pai's FCC also basically let all the ISP self-report on broadband deployment. So companies would say, oh yeah, we're serving in this area and this other company is serving in that area and we're doing this and this is competitive, so you need to give us more money to roll out to this other area. And then it would never happen. And we gave them billions over those 4 years to facilitate broadband rollouts that technically happened. If you look at one house on a block, they were able to sign up service for like one family, but not really. And so that's all they needed to sort of cheat their maps on how they were funding all of this broadband. It's awful. We've been fleeced several times over. Numerous times over, and we could have been doing so much better if we had actually regulated this stuff instead of kind of owing to this Reagan era notion of free market, which is just so dumb. Ron Guido, as wireless internet becomes better, cable just might have to get better. I doubt, because I took Verizon's home 5G service for a spin. It's very good. Wireless can't be cabled. If it's copper cabling to home or if it's fiber to home, fiber is obviously the gold standard. Wireless is still drawing from the same nodes. So you've got fiber channels going to towers, and then those towers sort of belch out a signal over a wide area of land. A 5G service can be very beneficial to areas where they haven't rolled the copper or they haven't rolled the fiber. That can help. But that node is still getting its traffic from data centers near it. So it's kind of like the promise of 5G never really materialized because, yeah, we put a faster router on your modem, but we didn't make the modem faster. We didn't improve the data going to the modem. So whatever you get locally, the wireless version, I'm sorry, whatever you can get locally for cable, the wireless version is going to be about the same or slower. So what I got on Spectrum was a little more consistent and faster than what I could get on Verizon. And for a brief moment, I had both. So I had them aggregated on my router. That was really nice. I really can't justify spending double on two internet services to make one internet at home a little bit faster. It does not economically work for me at all. But you can't evade the infrastructure of the area. If we had fiber to home, especially in this neighborhood right here, then we would have fiber nodes going throughout this community. Our 5G services would get faster because we'd have more of that data, that fast data going through the whole area. And then the wireless services would also get better. But still, a wireless service fueled that way is not going to be as fast or as consistent as a cabled service of some kind. So the only solution that makes sense for the vast majority of Americans in residential areas, in suburbs, and in cities, is get the fiber rolled out. And then we can look at 5G distribution for communities that are much more rural and harder to cable and harder to get those types of services out there. We'll have a much better infrastructure around the major centers and then around the suburbs, and then we can leech off that to finish the last stages of those people who are completely underserved. Completely unserved. But we've got to start from the bulk first. We've got to start from all the dark fiber that we need to light up. We need to start getting fiber to the actual consumers, not just to a couple business hubs. And from there, we can spread more effectively. It's not going to happen, though, if the big plan from ISPs is, well, we need to make shareholders happy and show cancerous growth in profits, so I guess we'll squeeze Netflix harder again. Remember when we used to squeeze Netflix harder? Boy, that was great. Really, more money that way. Oh, McCorkerin. I'm completely on board that idea. Something like this would be perfect for a federal jobs program, but our country refuses to think like that. There's so many areas around the country right now where you've got highly skilled labor that would be good at this kind of deployment that their local economy, their local infrastructure has been wrecked. And you just... we've got all this talent and we've got people that could do this job. I would wholeheartedly endorse my taxpayers going to jobs for people that could do this deployment. They would have stronger, healthier, better financed communities. I would get fiber. Everyone would be happy. It would be huge. And we see it every single time we try it. It's a smashing success. I'm going to point people back to Chattanooga, Tennessee. It is an incredible success. The infrastructure was not that expensive to install. It's managed by the local power company. It is insanely profitable, and yet prices are radically competitive against traditional cable and DSL solutions. And now I think they have options for like 2 gig and 10 gig fiber in Tennessee. And again, gigabit is still destroying the most expensive plans at Comcast and Spectrum, but you pay a lot less for that in Chattanooga, Tennessee. It's almost like the Department of Energy was completely correct in funding taxpayer-fueled broadband to that city, and it was so successful that the rest of Tennessee said, no, you can't have it, because we're Republicans. No. It's better for everybody except for Comcast. You can't have it. Dave, I was joking when I said you guys should do a communism without me, but, you know, here we go. Comrade Juan at it again. I love it.
Just a quick interjection here, folks. I love highlighting good work and talented people. Producers and writers who deserve more attention. So here's a quick word from someone making cool stuff on the internet, and I hope you check out what they have to offer.
Do you like podcasts about tech?
Oh, yeah.
Do you like podcasts about tech where you... See, I already it up. That's okay, because I don't want to stop the recording because then we got to redo it all. So I'll just put it there. Do you like podcasts?
Yeah.
Do you like podcasts about tech?
Hell yeah.
Do you like podcasts about tech that have your favorite creators like Juan Carlos Bagnell, TK Bay, and many, many more?
Oh, yeah.
Well, if you do, you should check out the Nomad Tech Project with Sam and Joe. It's a podcast about everything tech. and sport and food and getting to know your favorite creators from the back end. Like, you know, you could watch their podcast and hear what they have to say about tech, but where did they go to high school? What did they like to do before they became a podcaster or a tech creator or a YouTuber or a Twitch streamer? Check us out. We're on every Sunday from 3 p.m. Central, 9 p.m. BST in the UK.
Ish.
We'd love to have you. Maybe throw a sub and tell your friends about it. Again, Nomad Tech Project with Sam and Joe on your favorite podcast aggregators. Take care. Love your faces. Be excellent to each other. We'll see you on the show.
Goodbye.
All right, where are we? I think I've got two more news blog stories. We're kind of closing in on the hour here. There's another story out of Canada that I just think is kind of interesting. I think it's something the rest of the world needs to keep an eye on. I am very anxious about this because of our recent change with Netflix. This is from the Free Press. I don't know this outlet. WinnipegFreePress.com. It's just where I caught the article. The Canadian press is, I want to say that this is an actual, like, kind of newspaper in Canada. I don't know. But from Dave Friend at the Canadian press, Netflix phases out basic streaming plan from its subscription options in Canada. The streaming giant says it's phasing out the $9.99 basic option from its price plans, taking away the cheapest subscription without ads. So now, you start off with a really cheap plan, Netflix with ads, then there's no more $9.99 plan, and I think you have to go up to $16. So I think the jump in Canada, in Canadian dollars, is now like $6 with ads, and then you got to jump to $16 to get streaming without ads. So let's watch, because that's the middle plan that we're on. We went from the $20 a month Netflix plan. We were like, this is silly. We don't need multiple screens, but we did like having 4K streaming. And we were like, oh, maybe we could kick it down to 1080. And Marie and I just talked, and you're like, we don't even need two screens at a time. If I could just pay for one screen with 4K, I would do that. But they don't offer that. They say that there's a value on number of screens and resolution, but they combine them in the most idiotic ways. So I can't have a single screen plan at the highest resolution. So we kicked it down to the single screen. We went down to the 720p streaming. It doesn't bother us. I mean, yeah, it doesn't look quite as nice or crisp or sharp, but it hasn't changed our viewing habits at all. And it just increasingly we're watching Netflix less. The main reason why we're holding on to Netflix are a bunch of kids shows that I like for Lex, especially because I won't let Lex anywhere near YouTube Kids. So there are a bunch of kids shows. I like that she has her own profile. It's very easy for us to set the parental controls on what she can watch. And then I am kind of into some of the Netflix game catalog, but I could easily give that up. Like, I don't need it, but it's nice to have. And so now we have to keep an eye out. Is there going to be a similar initiative here in the United States where they cut the single screen plan to try and force people into more expensive single screen with ads plans? It's so frustrating. I really feel Netflix has completely fumbled the consumer conversation on this. And I'm actually sort of in support of a part of what they're talking about and how they encouraged password sharing and then walked it back. That's a bad look. But when you see how many people were utilizing Netflix services without paying for them, I understand why you would want to try and monetize those viewers. But if you're going to tell me that the number of screens you can stream to has a financial value, and that the resolution has a financial value, then let me come up with one account as an umbrella, and then each individual user under that account is monetized in a different way. If I have someone on my account and I want to pay for their Netflix with ads, I can set up that as a low-cost account. And then Marie and I can have a home 4K account. And then Lex doesn't need a 4K account, but I don't want her watching commercials, so we'll pay for a 720p ad-free account. And we could make and staple together all of those, and I would probably end up paying Netflix more. But they won't give it to me. They won't let me pick how I want to use their service when they set the values on what each part of that should resemble. So, no, we're not going to mess with this. We're going to hold on to our 720p option, and if they cancel this 720p single screen plan that we're on, if we can't keep it because we were grandfathered, if it eventually goes away, or they say, oh, well, you've got to switch to the two screen plan, isn't that going to be great? Now two people can watch Netflix. We're just going to cancel Netflix. It's gone. I'm done. I'm over it. I think we as consumers have given them every opportunity to approach this from a more rational and a better financial area for them. I feel Netflix would make more money if they stopped the stupid geolocation. Your device has to report home to be a part of this plan. It is so stupid complicated and so consumer, anti-consumer in its structure. It's so confusing in how it's implemented. And instead, if they had made this easier and just said, hey, from now on, you pay per use. I have a Mint Mobile home account. We have separate, technically, it's two separate lines. I have a phone line for Marie with a certain amount of data every month, and I have a phone line for me at a certain amount of data every month, and we pay one big bill every year. And it's real easy to say, hey, you know what? We saw how Marie was never hitting her data cap. Let's go down a level for Marie. But you saw how I was every so often kind of going over or maxing out. So we're going to go up one tier for me. And we ended up paying Mint Mobile the same amount of money, but we did it on plans that now will better suit each of our individual needs. And Netflix could totally do that. They're choosing not to by making this so much more complicated. They're hoping consumers will just pay more. Well, if they just buy up the food chain, then some of these problems and some of these pain points just disappear. And no, we're not going to advocate for that. I am not going to advocate for a business model that is predicated on pain points, encouraging spending more to get a basic tier of service that's somewhat more reasonable to use. You could set up your business in a way where someone could get what they need from you, and you would make more money over time. I'm not playing this game. So unfortunately, and again, for our Canadian pals, you just became the little test market to see if this is going to work and encourage people to spend more. And I feel bad for you guys. Pack us in, which reminds me to check where I can grab Stargate SG-1 for cheaper. Oh man, Steve, my in-laws gave up cable and regular streaming for pirate IPTV. I mean, you know what we need to do is where our TV is mounted, I'm not sure where I can put an antenna. But we never replaced YouTube TV. So yeah, when YouTube TV recently did its big price hike too, we just put the service on pause and we're like, you know what? We really haven't been watching a ton of TV. We were paying like almost $70 a month for this thing that we would occasionally use. And one of the main things is like Marie liked watching morning news, like the local news channel here in the morning. They stream their news on their website in HD. And so she was like, oh, all I need to do is go to localnewsite.com. That's not the note. Don't do that. I have no idea where that web address will really take you. But then she's watching the news. You're like, bam, there just went 85% of our YouTube TV usage was the local channel that we could probably get for free on an over-the-air antenna. We just get ratcheted into this false notion of convenience. And man, it is not more convenient. It is almost no difference in, you know, firing up a Chromecast and going to YouTube TV and getting the local news channel to stream on YouTube TV as it is to just go to their site. It's less work. So So we're going to wrap up the news block, the really long news block, because I spent way too long on housekeeping. One last story. For all of the positive press that Apple gets, it's very important that we continue to at least mention what a $1 trillion organization is doing as it pertains to relating to their customers and then also relating to their employees. So this is a very big deal. This is the first court case to really kind of land with Apple on the other side of a verdict like this. Coming directly from Bloomberg, written up by Josh Idelson, Apple illegally interrogated staff about union judge rules. First time an NLRB judge has issued a decision against Apple. The company has, of course, denied any wrongdoing. Apple coercively interrogated retail employees about their pro-union sympathies and restricted the circulation of union flyers, a U.S. Labor Board judge ruled, marking a victory for labor organizers at the world's most valuable company. In a Tuesday decision, a National Labor Relations Board judge wrote that Apple violated the rights of employees at its World Trade Center store in New York City, one of several around the country where workers waged union campaigns last year. The judge wrote that Apple should be required to cease and desist from coercively interrogating workers about their legally protected labor activism. It should stop confiscating pro-union literature in its break rooms and, quote, interfering with restraining or coercing employees, end quote, in the exercise of their rights, according to this decision. And I love that immediately, like after this, there's like a little block paragraph from an Apple spokesperson, which is like, no, but we're great. It's the thing. It's like, I love to see these court cases won. What I also feel needs to happen now is if Apple is found to have worked against those kinds of conversations, which are legally protected, employees should be able to talk to themselves about things like wages and unionizing if they want to talk about that stuff, is that Apple should not be able to just put out a press release saying, but we don't. We don't bully. It's not in our corporate... The CEO, Tim Cook, testified before a Senate hearing that Apple doesn't bully, and he was under oath. So you know he's telling the truth. So we don't bully, except for all the times that we do. But don't pay attention to that, because we don't. That is not something that we do. Well, let me actually read the quote. Apple fosters an open and inclusive work environment whereby employees are not just permitted, but encouraged to share their feelings and thoughts on a range of issues, from social justice topics to pay equity to anything else that they feel is an important cause to promote in the workplace. And all of those things are things that Apple has been found and discussed as trying to work against. People have come out of Apple saying, boy howdy, do they not take kindly to these kinds of conversations like pay equity or organizing unions. And now in this court case, a labor relations judge says, no, Apple did infringe on the rights of workers. So I feel a part of, in the future, obviously it won't ever happen because Apple is a $1 trillion company. And for some reason they get special consideration in everything that they do, even when they harm workers' rights, when they lie to their consumers about their products, or when they steal intellectual property from other companies and produce products at scale with IP theft. Apple gets this like holding pattern where they're allowed to kind of just keep being Apple. Microsoft will get trashed every single time. But Apple, for some reason, is special, and it makes me sort of bile in my stomach, kind of rage. I feel like moving forward, none of this matters unless Apple is forced to publicly admit, hey, we need to hold ourselves to a higher standard. As a corporate entity, the actions of this store do not represent the executives at Apple, but this is what took place, and we will work harder to encourage employees to voice their concerns, to converse with other employees, and so that it's on the record and that it's public, not. We were found guilty, but nah, uh-uh. No, we don't do that. I mean, the judge said we did and that we were guilty of it, but we say we didn't. We investigated ourselves and we found that we're awesome. We're awesome sauce. We're awesome applesauce. So just don't be a stinky Android owner and get your mom an iPhone, because green bubbles and blue bubbles. So, but we don't bully. We just profit immensely from the social conditioning of other people making using competitive products harder, which is sort of like bullying psychologically, but it's not, because we said so. Paco Stint, small number of managers may experience. Dave, but Juan, you are just a hater. And again, for no reason, right? So if you read through my YouTube comments, it's like, Juan just hates for no reason. He is just a hater and the haterade. There is no reason to be critical of the corporations like Apple and Samsung. Mer, 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 mer. Yeah, Dave Burns, we profit immensely from the bullying of our customers. We at Apple don't bully, except for when we totally bully developers and customers. And yeah, it's great. It's great. It's great. It's great. So, I mean, this show is really mismatched and sort of all over the place. This is normally where we would hold a subreddit plug, reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles. My subreddit is still private, and I still have not been removed from my subreddit as moderator. So I doubt we'll see any drama there for a while, because my subreddit was big, but not huge. The mission of Glowing Rectangles was to help share content we felt deserved more attention. Could be from a major YouTube channel, could be from a small editorialist, could be from someone just sharing photos directly to the subreddit. Some of our most popular posts have been someone just like, hey, I got a new phone and I took this photo and it was great. And it got a ton of upvotes. So just because the functional web address, reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles, is currently private, and I will keep it private indefinitely until I see some change in executive leadership at Reddit, the mission of Glowing Rectangles is still to promote and to support content creators that we care about. I started this whole podcast off talking about losing my favorite enthusiast geek smartphone podcast. It's gone. It is not coming back, and nothing is on the horizon that will replace what we lost. So what we lost was sort of priceless in that regard. With whatever effort or energy or reach that you as an individual might be able to sustain, when you see cool content, just watching it is insufficient. If you want to see more cool content of that variety or of that flavor, then going out of your way to not just like and subscribe and smash that bell icon, but to share it with people you feel are like-minded is the biggest step you can take to supporting that content creator. I don't have a singular platform that matches the convenience and the ease of use of having a subreddit as a public forum that is easy to find, that people can search, and that other people can discover content on. But I'm still asking that you make the effort to continue supporting the content creators out there that are making cool stuff. You're losing them. You're losing them faster than you realize. You're not aware of it if you're only looking at like your YouTube algorithmically sorted feed when you open the YouTube app, because YouTube isn't going to show you the big gaps. Oh, you haven't seen anything from Scott Peachy, at Technically Speaking. Like, he hasn't made anything in a while. So you're not going to see that big empty block where Scott used to deliver this really great, fun, charming, insightful commentary on smartphones. YouTube just fills that gap with something else. You're not seeing monitor and display comparisons from Erica Griffin anymore. YouTube isn't showing you the missing block in your subscription feed where an Erica Griffin video might have been. that block just disappears and gets filled by something else. And then we complain, oh, but tech is boring and everything seems kind of the same and oh, I'm just hearing the same things over and over again. And that helps with the signal spread from manufacturers, and it contributes to this sort of decay of the enthusiast community. If we don't make the effort to step outside the algorithmically sorted content distribution of a YouTube or a Facebook, any of the Facebook services, or Twitter now especially, just for how toxic Twitter has become, then the rest of our communities will perish. And we're seeing it play out in real time. I am not being histrionic. I'm showing you weekly. Here's yet another content creator that we are going to lose. Here's yet another podcast that is being taken off the air. Here's the photography website, DP Review, getting bought out by a really weird website. And the hosts, thankfully, went off to Petapixel. So if you love that kind of great, informed experience in camera conversations, it's not enough to just kind of subscribe to Petapixel and sort of watch whenever they might put a video out. I subscribed and I smashed the bell icon and I missed three videos. Three from the hosts over that were formerly at DP Review who are now over at Petapixel. I didn't get notifications on them. YouTube did not serve me their content. So I had to manually go to the Petapixel YouTube channel and watch the videos that YouTube never sent my way. And then I was also really encouraged to see they started their own podcast. So I'm going to also put this out as a plug. Subscribe to the Petapixel podcast where you can listen to their thoughts on photography and cameras and tech and gear. They did an episode talking about the Apple Vision Pro. They were far kinder to it than I was. Isn't that a good sort of comparative idea from professionals in the photography industry rather than just listening to me whine about Apple yet again? You could stop this podcast right now and go listen to the Petapixel podcast on Apple Vision Pro. So if you didn't know any of that, there was no way for you to find it. YouTube is not going to help you find that. They're just going to keep filling the gaps, the missing segments of content that you would have gotten with other stuff. And it might not be the stuff that you want to watch, but you know, it's convenient because it's right there. It's right in front of me. I can just click play. We need to make the effort to take that step. And it's not even like completely leave the platform. It's just take the step to look for things beyond what YouTube just casually serves in our feed. My mission was glowing rectangles. I worked on that subreddit for 9 years. Finally got it to a place where I felt it was contributing to the conversation. It was being a good feeder for people to find content outside of YouTube, outside of Facebook, outside of Twitter. And unfortunately, Reddit went and did the same thing that I found abhorrent on all of these other social media platforms. So continue. Please make the effort. Share. Converse. Leave comments. But more than just the passive watch or the passive read, I gave them a click. It's unfortunately not enough. And I'm going to keep making this plea, but something tells me, even with the amazing group of people that are sort of in my chat right now, I feel like it's going to get a lot worse before it gets better. So, RIP All About Android, RIP DP Review. I don't know what the heck is going to happen to that website when it finally does change ownership and it lands in this new website's hands. Take a look around, because I don't think we like what's happening. But if we don't change our behavior, then what is happening all around us is just going to continue. And that's a bummer. Really don't want that. Yeah, random hobby. I mean, and again, it's like, I definitely appreciate this. What I'm saying isn't just as easy as, well, just be better. Random hobby says, I'm subscribed to 700 channels and I only scroll my subscription feed because the recommendations are crap. I wish there was a better way to mark and remove videos from the queue without unsubbing. And it's tough. Because we also used subscribing as a way to say, I liked the video that I watched, but I probably don't care to watch other videos from this creator in the future. Clicking the like button doesn't do what we think it does. Clicking the subscribe button from the psychology of the end user doesn't really do what we think it does. And yet YouTube is using that as the metrics and the data to kind of funnel viewers to the things that they think will already be the most popular. And it's a mess. YouTube is a dumpster fire right now for that. And I don't think there's an easy solution. But what we can do is, those of us who do care about this kind of stuff, we can kind of share amongst ourselves, and we can be the feeder that will hopefully shine a little light and popularize another video or an article or a new content creator or a new YouTube channel, an established YouTube channel that might be struggling a little bit. We don't want to lose another All About Android if we care about Android. That would be bad, because there isn't one. We would be negative podcasts on Android. So from John Gao, DP Review's ownership already changed. Hopefully the new owners can let them do the same things in the past. Look up the channel, or look up the website that DP Review got bought by, and it looks like all of the fake articles that are just stapled as advertisements. Like, what it's called something like gearreview.com or something like that. And you go to their actual reviews page, and I think the first review that they have up is of a whiskey. And like, I am not confident in the ownership of this new entity buying DP Review and maintaining the same quality of consistent reviews and of journalistic business practices, disclosures, and they've already lost a lot of talent. So like, again, Jordan and Chris were their on-air hosts for their YouTube channel. They went to Petapixel. They're making videos over there. And if you want that high production value video, it's not a DP Review. They're making a podcast, the Petapixel podcast. I've listened to the first three episodes. It's a really well-hosted podcast. So it's, again, there will be a functional website called twitter.com or reddit.com or dpreview.com. But what made each of those sites interesting and unique has already died. And I don't know that it can be revived. So we got a couple things here in the gadget block that I want to cover. Some stuff that, like, just want to keep an eye on it. And then also I want to support some really good work here. There it went. Okay, good. Sorry, I have like notes in three different places, and I'm really glad that you can't see the screen share that I put up for like my whole monitor, because it's kind of a mess. You would be very disappointed in my ability to organize and produce a podcast. Let me go into screen share here. So I feel like this could be the first step at making an actual practical Steam Deck killer. I'm not a fan of YouTube channels that do sort of like gadget destruction videos. Like, to me, that's just dumb. Like, let me see if I can try and break this phone. Oh, looks like it broke. How lame. The folks at iFixit are my absolute first resource to ever see what actually goes into the construction and the repairability of a product. And they finally did a video, put it out 2 days ago. ROG Ally Teardown, great hardware with a big butt. This is the first potential portable PC console thing that I think can give the Steam Deck a run for its money. I still viciously disagree that any handheld gaming product that is more powerful than the Steam Deck is a Steam Deck killer. The reason why I love my Steam Deck is not only its ability to play games on the go and deliver surprisingly decent graphics capabilities, it's the entire community, it's the software, it's the repairability, and it's the fact that replacement parts are easily found in the distribution, in the ecosystem. So even when a Steam Deck 2 comes out, whatever that looks like as a refined Steam Deck, I'm going to hold it to that same standard, is that I want to see that the store and the interactions are the easiest and most streamlined way for me to find, buy, and play games. And if something goes wrong with my Steam Deck, I need the most streamlined process of finding repair parts and repair services for that product. And when we have all of that wrapped up together, then I think we've got the competition to call something a Steam Deck killer. You cannot operate at that scale with these little boutique handheld devices. They do not have the infrastructure to put out parts at that scale, and they too quickly flip their devices. So, oh, this Aya is so much more powerful than the Steam Deck. And, oh, a new one is coming out in another month. There's a new Kickstarter project for another Steam Deck killer. Is not real. That's not a phrase. The Steam Deck will be killed when we have something that not only performs better, but satisfies all of the other concerns. The reason why the Nintendo Switch has continued to hold on to the position that it has in the gaming market is not because of its graphics prowess. It is the price to performance and the ability to find accessories and parts and replacements and repairs with a great catalog of software to enjoy. That's why the Nintendo Switch is a juggernaut. And that's why I like the Steam Deck. So that was way too much whining and complaining. iFixit has a teardown on the ROG Ally, and I really like what they're showing in this video. So when future products are built by other companies, like I wholly expect that Dell is going to make some kind of portable, HP might make some kind of portable. It's just too good. I mean, it's such a good idea, and they don't need to be responsible for all of the infrastructure in handling, you know, stores and software and licensing and all that. But the costs for these components are kind of coming in line with consumer expectations. You can make a portable PC console, make it pretty good, and deliver it at scale. This is what we need to see. I want to see the ease of accessibility, of operation, of disassembly. And I think iFixit has done a phenomenal job of taking a look at what's actually inside the ROG Ally. Now I feel we're getting some real competition for the Steam Deck. Dave, oh, you bugger. Dave says, but Juan, I am a gamer. I'm inherently averse to nuance. Well, I feel you have just put too much politics in my podcast, Dave. I remember when games were not about politics, and here you are being political by even talking about gamers, because that is a political thing. People exist.
Hey, podcast listeners, I work really hard to find mutually beneficial ways to support production on my various distribution platforms. Instead of just running ads on this podcast and hoping they don't annoy you, I want to find products or services that you really will get something out of and that can help fund my production. While I do talk about some of those items in ads throughout this podcast, I've never created one easy-to-view master list of my current partnerships until now. Sorry, I couldn't help myself. If you'd like to help contribute, support production of this podcast and my various videos and reviews, head on over to somegadgetguy.com. At the top, there's going to be a link for Support Some Gadget Guy, and you can see what my current partnerships are. At the time this podcast was recorded, in addition to my Patreon, we can hook you up with a $10 voucher for shopping a new OnePlus, save 20% on some One More headphones, sign you up for Google Fi service, Amazon affiliate links, Audible, or you can grab a Mega Pickle coffee mug of your very own. Savory, delicious Mega Pickles. Head on over to SomeGadgetGuy.com, support banner on the top right-hand side of my website, and hopefully you find something cool, something you like, while also kicking me a little extra scratch.
Oh, Gormlord, we have the Sony Project Q coming for the Steam Deck. What was the rumored price on that? Someone came out with like an announcement. Like, I think it came because of some of the FTC conversations between Microsoft and Activision. Someone said that the Project Q was going to be something like $300. And everyone's acting like, oh, this is so outlandishly expensive. I don't think you can make a screen with good controllers and wireless radios and enough compute power to operate all of this well, with RAM and storage to buffer the local software and handle the graphics and the processing that still have to be streamed to the display, with a battery that can be charged reliably and comply with FCC regulations. I don't think you can make something like that cheap. I saw a bunch of people was like, oh, if it's more than like $100 and a half a ham sandwich, then it's going to be a failure. I think the concept is kind of suspect no matter what the price is. Can we just sort of say the game streaming solution where you run your PlayStation 5 to then stream games to a dedicated handheld that you buy that's separate from another tablet or from another phone or something like that is already a difficult pill to swallow. But when Logitech tried to build a game streaming device out at scale, it was around $350, wasn't it? Didn't it launch closer to $400 and then they scaled back the price? And the main focus of the Logitech was you sign up to Steam or Game Pass or Nvidia and you stream your games to this. And there is enough compute power to kind of play games locally, some Android games on it, but really that's not what the main purpose of this thing is going to be. And I want to say that was a more expensive product. Like, it was like a $300-ish dollar handheld. Sitting next to me right now is my Razer Edge. I've been putting a ton of mileage on this thing. And I've also been like letting Lex play a lot of games. Like, she's surprisingly into Dead Cells. And I feel bad because like she goes to like hang out with friends and they're like, I like to play Sonic. And she's like, I've got a laser whip. I am the Dead Cells guy and you cannot kill me. I am immortal. Waka, waka. And none of those kids know anything about Dead Cells. And then I have to explain the concept to some of the other parents and they think I'm like the worst parent ever, but it's such a good game. And her tactile controller skills are just radically improving because she's playing a precision platformer roguelite. Whereas these other kids couldn't make it through a single level in Sonic, like the original Sonic the Hedgehog, forget about it. So I point to this because people act like this is a ridiculous concept as a surprisingly powerful and adept game playing solution at $399. It's a $400 mini tablet with a great controller add-on and active cooling for better sustained performance. And people act like, oh, but that's so expensive and who would ever want to buy that? And mobile gaming sucks. And you're like, boy, you just really don't know what you're talking about. So the PlayStation Q at $300, unfortunately, I think is the correct price for all of that hardware. The issue is the concept for how we play and move games from a singular location. And that's a major issue. That is a major problem in the game industry right now. You cannot easily recreate the experience of movie distribution or television show distribution to online. It doesn't work that way. There's some good ideas there, but nothing that is inherently necessary to a standalone product until we can solve some of these problems. And then maybe it makes sense. Like, you can take your Sony Q handheld thing and play games out at the beach, and they're being, you know, they're being rendered by your PlayStation, but then they can be played somewhere else where you have a data connection. Sure, I get that. We can't have that if we don't have good upstream data connections in our home internet. So the vast majority of Americans will never get to play with that. I cannot get data up to the internet in a timely enough fashion to play a game remotely if I'm rendering the graphics from my home workstation or from my PS4. Does not work. So the concept is the problem. The hardware looks like it's priced appropriately. Like, I think it's correct. But instead, I would probably point people more to like a Razer Edge. Get a better multimedia tablet. It does all the Android-y stuff better. It's a little bit bigger than a phone. It has fans on it to sustain performance. It's still really cheap at $399. That is not a crazy expensive price. And then you can borrow from a couple different gaming catalogs to flesh out that gaming experience. Yeah, see, Gormlord, see, this is fair. I'm sure it will be great hardware, but expensive, especially for something you can already do on your phone or your Razer Edge. Yeah. Something tells me this Razer Edge is going to be more performant and a better gaming experience than what the PlayStation Q will be if we ever try to find a way to run games locally on that PlayStation. I don't think that's going to work. But I'll tell you, you know, like, even up into, like, Alien Isolation, I've got a Doom 3 emulator, like, there's some really, really good gaming that you can handle on this Razer Edge. It's really frustrating because, like, as soon as you talk about it, you get someone who's like, "Oh, well, actually, Android gaming sucks, and it's just Candy Crush and microtransactions and in-app purchases." And you're like, I am almost positive that that person has dumped a ton of money into, like, skins on their favorite, like, battle royale. Like, I have no patience. It's another quick little bit of news here, something just to kind of warm the heart for all of the dourness that I've had about competition in the mobile space. Sony and Qualcomm have announced a multi-year collaboration to deliver next-generation smartphones. I'm going to link directly to the Qualcomm press release. They don't say exactly how long, I don't think. Is extended its collaboration with Snapdragon, future smartphones. Companies agreed to work together on the next generations of premium high and mid-tier smartphones. So we know that there's at least two more years of Sony hardware coming out. It just, again, we get real anxious when, like, there's a smaller player in the space. Will we keep getting Xperia phones? I don't know. But a move like this where they specifically say for the coming generations, I hope that means we'll see an Xperia 1 Mark 6 and an Xperia 1 Mark 7. We at least, you're telling me there's a chance. Dave Burns, sick, a two-year collaboration. Ghost Starscream. Sorry, just working back. Who's willing to bet that Project Q will only run on the PlayStation 5 software, but won't be able to run PS5 locally on the device? I mean, we all know it won't. There's no way that you can pack PlayStation 5 performance into a handheld and like have it run appropriately. Gormlord saying, I'm playing the Android port of Chrono Trigger right now. Nuff said. And Kenox. Come on, Kenox. No. There we go. Mobile games have gotten pretty good. My gripe is that a lot of mobile games don't have driver support for a game controller or mouse and keyboard. And that's the thing I think has improved the most over the last couple of years. Older games aren't really bringing that attention. So if you're playing an older game and it doesn't support controllers, it's really not going to support controllers in the future. But when you look at new titles coming out, we've seen phenomenal improvements. I was really happy to play TMNT Shredder's Revenge through Netflix, supported controllers, and still had the same capabilities for collaborative play. So if you wanted to join someone else's match, you could just jump right in. The data worked like that. It was so refreshing to see. It was exactly the same game as it was on Android as it was anywhere else. I'm trying to think, like, recently of the games that have kind of messed me up. The Transformers game on Netflix was specifically built to be, it's sort of a Street Fighter meets Transformers mashup, but all of the controls are only mobile. Like, if you play it, you swipe for this kind of attack, you swipe for this kind of a dodge, you have to, like, double swipe and do all these other things. I don't know that there would have been a way to just translate that into button presses. The entire flow of the game is built to kind of find a rhythm to your attacks as a Transformer. So that was built mobile only. So yeah, you put a controller on, you're like, this would be kind of fun if I could play this with a controller, but there's also no way to play it with a controller because of the way that the developers built the game to be a touchscreen game. But the other game that I think is going to be really exciting, just in time for my birthday, a major upgrade is coming to Vampire Survivors, 4-player couch co-op. What? Vampire Survivors has been the game that I have burnt the most amount of time on over the last year. I'm at 170 hours of playing Vampire Survivors, and I've been playing a bunch of other games. It's not that I've only been playing Vampire Survivors. I play a lot of games. I don't talk about them as much in this kind of context because I like my game playing to be a relaxation activity and not a side hustle for me to produce more content. Why are you adding couch co-op to Vampire Survivors? because it's fun and Couch Co-op is one of the most requested community features. How much does the Couch Co-op update cost? Nothing. The co-op update will be completely free. When does the Couch Co-op update launch? August 17th. How does the Couch Co-op update change the gameplay? And then they actually write out something here. While we can't go into too many details, we can already say that the gameplay stays largely the same, more chaos aside, though adding more players changes a few gameplay systems, of course. For example, you will share the level up bar with the experience points with your friends and level up in turns. All players will always be visible on the same screen, so no split screen, and there will also be a few ways to sabotage each other, just so you know. Pick Gati Amari, which is one of my least favorite weapons in Vampire Survivors, and one of Lex's favorite weapons in Vampire Survivors. So, right around my birthday, I am planning some daddy-daughter Vampire Survivor couch co-op time. I am insanely excited about the potential for this silly little individual indie game. I'm telling you, if you really haven't given it a fair shot, this is the thing. If you're really into like battle royale, third person or first person perspective gaming, I get it. I can't play first person shooters anymore. I play for about 5 minutes and then I get motion sickness and I want to throw up. It makes me really sad because I used to be super into first person shooters when I was younger. I literally can't stomach them anymore. It has nothing to do with the amazing work or the communities or the gameplay. I just physically cannot play them, and I've never found a solution for minimizing the impact of that motion sickness. But it has completely rekindled my love of platformers, roguelites, twin-stick shooters, all these other fun arcadey styles of gameplay. So you pick up Vampire Survivors, and you play for a couple minutes and you go, yeah, I get it. You run away from enemies and then you die. But the gameplay loop of building a strategy, of trying to create this amazing demon-killing character is insanely satisfying. So once you have to get over the initial hurdle of like, I'm just walking around and I can't even control my weapon attacks. The weapons attack at pre-timed intervals, and all I'm responsible for is moving this little character around. And you think that's the gameplay, but the gameplay is really your strategy. What am I focusing on? What am I building? What am I upgrading? It's really a management strategy game, a resource management game. You get all of your gems and you upgrade your experience. You get these options. They come out you kind of randomly, and then you've got to pick, okay, well, what do I want to focus on for this build, or how do I get to the end game of this map, or is there something that I'm looking for specifically in this map? It is amazing. So I got my mom kind of playing it a little bit. I don't think she's really going to stick with it, but you know, my daughter can now, on her own, make it to the end game, make it to a completed run in Vampire Survivors. I can't wait until we can do couch co-op, because I bet you, because she loves Gati Amari, I bet you she is going to, the gameplay is going to change from can she make it to the end at 30 minutes to can she kill daddy before the end of the round? And I know for a fact that she is hilarious about trying to smack talk when she's playing other games. She is witheringly brutal at Uno. She's really good at playing Uno. So, That had to make it into the news blog. I am silly excited to see continued updates. The game, I think, full price, Vampire Survivors is like $7 with all the DLC. Maybe $8. I can't remember. I have bought everything twice just so that I could have it on PC and my Steam Deck and to have all of the current DLC on Android. And so I'm rebuilding my character on Android, largely playing it on my Razer Edge. It is just such a fun, casual, but strategy-focused gaming experience. Dave Burns, Lex is going to kick your butt. Apparently, her favorite weapon item is OP Bort. Gormlord, no complaining on the podcast when Lex crushes you in Vampire Survivors. I love it. Dave Burns, you played it first on the podcast. It's basically SGG canon at this point. The first game stream you did in like years. I tried to do a game stream for Command & Conquer Mobile, and it hurt my soul so badly. I put on pause these plans that I had to like do more mobile game reviews. And then it just sort of stuck. I had these plans, like I was going to do this, I was going to do a game stream, I was going to focus on desktop mode so you could play games on TVs. I had this like idea, this roadmap, and I made it 45 minutes into a stream on Command & Conquer Mobile, and something died inside my soul. That Command & Conquer Mobile was so bad. And I really didn't want to be yet another YouTube channel just contributing to the commentary on all mobile games suck. Yeah, that was rough. John Gao, bring back Tetris with TK. So Marie and I still play Tetris pretty regularly. And I play Tetris all by myself. Tetris Effect is amazing. And I don't know that TK wants to play Tetris with me anymore, because for him, Tetris is like a fun little casual thing that he visits a couple times a year. And for me, Tetris is flow state stress relief. So when I play competitively, unless I'm playing with folks who are regularly playing on JSTris, the rounds are pretty quick. they don't last very long. So I don't know, maybe we'll do another game night on the Patreon if anyone wants to just hang out and play some JSTris, and I won't take it so seriously. I'll just kind of fart around, but we can just hang out and do some game streaming there. Mountain Dew, Tetris Effect Connected is brilliant. It is incredible. I played Tetris Effect on an original 5 1/4 floppy, 1988, on an 8088 XT clone DOS machine. I have been playing Tetris my entire conscious life. My mom and I used to viscerally fight in Tetris showdowns through decades of computing. Tetris Effect Connected is just incredible to me that we are still crafting new flavors of this experience, and that Tetris is and always will be sort of a perfect reflex video game. We're going to find amazing opportunities to tell stories. That's not Tetris. Tetris is not a way to tell stories. Tetris is like the summation of my childhood arcade reflex gameplay, and it will live on forever. Tetris will always exist in some form. It's amazing. I cannot say enough nice things about Tetris Effect Connected. But then also, if you want to get real pissy, a good showdown on Puyo Puyo Tetris is pretty good for some smack talk too. I actually think Marie likes Puyo Puyo Tetris better, even though she doesn't regularly beat me in Puyo Puyo Tetris. But I'll peek over, and sometimes, you know, we'll just be in bed, and maybe I'll be noodling around on my Steam Deck or playing on my Razer Edge, and I'll look over and she's got JSTris up in a web browser on her phone. So I know she's like, oh, maybe I'm training a little quietly in the background so I can send more garbage. It's like it encourages you to like get good and to get better. We're going to close out the show because we're talking about gaming, and here's something that I'm mad that I hope it's good, but I'm mad that they didn't think of doing this transition sooner or trying this as a pilot program sooner. I'm still positive on the idea of game streaming. I have a Game Pass account, and I don't actually install a lot of games on my Windows machines through Game Pass. I stream a lot, again, because I've got access to some good hardware. I can pop a phone into a controller like my GameSir, which has active cooling on it. I've got my Razer Edge. I can fire up my Steam Deck. All of these have pipelines that can take me to a game streaming service like Game Pass, and on good Wi-Fi, it's pretty decent. There are a couple games where you're like, yeah, it doesn't make sense to play game streaming this way, but for most of the titles I like to play, it's been awesome. And especially, like, I love showing it off. Like, I was playing through Hellblade again, because we got the announcement that Hellblade 2 is on the horizon. Well, I was playing it on the Robo and Kala, The Robo Ancala, as an ARM-based tablet laptop, is not powerful enough to really play Hellblade. But firing it up on Game Pass, on decent Wi-Fi, that is a great gaming experience. So the company I feel most responsible for the proof of concept was Google. Google killed Stadia. And I really wish that they had found some other lower visibility solution for that infrastructure. Like, maybe Stadia isn't the service that works directly with the gamers, but Stadia could be the service that is the backbone of another company looking to do game streaming. Like, maybe Stadia is the resource that Valve could use to initiate some kind of PC game streaming service. The licensing on that gets really complicated. The distribution on that gets really complicated. We can see all of the teething pains that NVIDIA has had to work through in instituting something similar. But why walk away? Google demonstrated one of the best ecosystems, the hardware, the actual infrastructure. They did it. They did it really, really well. Well, we're getting some rumors that there might be a new game service coming from YouTube. YouTube is reportedly testing online games for mobile and desktop. The gaming product is called Playables. Users will be able to play them on the YouTube website using a web browser or on the app, whether on an Android or an iOS phone. While the report insinuates that there are currently several games available for testing, it only mentioned Stack Bounce in particular. It's an ad-supported arcade game that gets players to smash layers of bricks with a bouncing ball. As the publication notes, YouTube already earns money from gaming live streams, but this product will give it another way to generate revenue from the industry in the midst of a decline in advertising spending. I feel this one was kind of obvious. We've failed three times now to really popularize YouTube gaming, right? YouTube gaming has existed as like a browser-based service, as its own dedicated app, and then just kind of withered into this weird, like, if you follow this account and this hashtag, you can see people who stream games on YouTube. They never succeeded in like displacing the mind share. Maybe it's competitive in terms of numbers, but in viewership, but the actual mind share of what Twitch represents, YouTube gaming never really fulfilled that. So you had Stadia, and Stadia kind of fell apart, but you could have immediately rolled the infrastructure of Stadia into a new generation of YouTube gaming powered by Stadia. And at the same time, Google is experimenting with a terrible platform for playing mobile games on PCs. Oh, I'm going to take a quick drink of water here. 1 second. So I did a short on this. It hasn't gotten any better. But there is an Android gaming emulation program that you can install on a Windows PC to play terrible gacha monetized in-app purchase ratcheted games on your computer. I have a Threadripper with a 2080 Ti. My machine is beefy, but it's by no means top of the line by today's standards. But that is ridiculous overkill for mobile gaming. If you fire up any of the games that you can kind of play cross-platform, like I think Genshin is one of them, it plays so much worse on my rig through the Android gaming software than it would be if I just installed it natively and played it directly. It plays so much worse through this terrible Android emulation factor than if you were to just install the game directly to Windows 11 using the Android subsystem for Windows. Microsoft makes a better platform for playing Android games than Google does for PC users. It is so dumb. It's so bad. So, if you were to encourage people to interact with YouTube as a place to not only stream games, but also play the games, this is a strategy that makes so much more sense. They already have the infrastructure. They've already demonstrated the data centers, the ability to stream content at scale. They had all of that Stadia tech. I feel now what they've done is they've shot themselves in the foot, because they could have passed the baton, but instead they killed one product, went a couple months, and now they're starting a new product. And that's what kills Google every single time. We've got a messaging app, and it's getting pretty popular. Let's kill it and introduce a new messaging app. And now this is confusing for consumers. So now we have a new messaging app. Let's kill it and roll some of those features into a different messaging app. We have a game streaming service. Oh no, it's not immediately popular. Let's kill it and let's wait a while. And now consumers will be excited to try a new flavor of a game streaming service from Alphabet, the makers of Stadia that they killed. There's no continuity. There's no consistency, and consumers do not trust Google at all. And again, Stadia would have succeeded if Google had any of that credibility and goodwill. People held off on Stadia and slow played it to see if Google would kill it. Fewer people really jumped into the Stadia experiment. Fewer people really tried it behind just kind of like little, oh, I tried it and I dipped my toe in the water and it worked okay, I guess. But I'll wait and see before I really spend money on it. And then Google didn't get the numbers that they wanted and then they killed it, which just reinforced all of the people that slow played and said, hey, I'm not going to jump on this in case Google kills it. And then they killed it. And see, I was correct in not getting involved in Stadia. And I instead went to Game Pass, further enriching Microsoft's position in this gaming market, which is now actually kind of becoming a disservice in their current negotiations and talks with the FTC and trying to acquire Activision. You see how all of that spirals? Everything. It's all Google's fault. So I feel this is genius branding. You've got your YouTube music, YouTube video, YouTube TV, and now YouTube gaming. Bring them all together and make this like a platform of services, and Google has the streaming infrastructure to make it work really well. But if their first thing is like, hey, now we can bring the worst predatory microtransaction games to computers easier, then no. If it's like a brick breaker game, I can already play better versions of that on my phones directly. I don't need to stream to an infrastructure. You need to have the licensing deals in place, or you need to have the studios directly making first-party content for that service. But the tech is sound. The tech works. I just need to see the content. That's always been Google's biggest problem, is where do we get the content? We don't have a bunch of YouTubers making games for free that we can just stream and promise them ad revenue. You actually got to put some muscle. You actually got to put some money behind people making games for a platform like that. So it's pretty great. It's pretty great. Yeah, DTNO, the Google software multiverse. It's the cinema universe of Google apps, all called YouTube. I love it. Oh, yeah, see, John Gao, that's exactly what I was talking about. See, John Gao caught it. I was about to make fun of his first comment here. John Gao says, Google is already doing that kind of white glove service based on Stadia. And I was about to jump in. He says, actually, never mind. Google shut down the white label game streaming offering in March. I told you. So we might see a YouTube playables, I guess. So you've got YouTube movies. You don't really have YouTube originals anymore, but you do have YouTube music, YouTube TV, and I guess YouTube playables is going to be coming to a smartphone or a browser near you. I'm going to give it a try. I really wanted the Android desktop gaming emulation to work better, because I feel it could legitimize some of this awful conversation we have around mobile gaming. But all Alphabet did was reinforce the worst predatory financial aspects of mobile gaming and tried to bring it to a PC. And I get it, that's where they're going to make more money, but it crushes the reputation of mobile gaming. If you try it, you're going to see a whole store full of some of the worst Android titles to ratchet that monetization, and all that's going to do is reinforce to people who are already not fans of Android gaming, oh, see, it's terrible. You should just get an Apple iPhone game subscription instead. And you're like, this isn't the way to do it. This is the perfect way to ruin the perception of something that's getting really good before it really has a chance to flourish. That's the word I'm looking for. So we should probably wrap this up. This was an interesting sort of... this was a tough collection of news blog stories to kind of walk through. And again, I just can't tell you how gutted I was over numerous announcements last week from some of people that I care very much about and people that I've worked with and people that I've chatted with online and communities and conversations and discourse. And it's been a running theme on this podcast for a couple years now, but it does seem like it's getting more and more precious by the day to keep reinforcing and to talking about how all this stuff works. I don't think people always understand what it takes to make something happen. The behind the scenes is a lot more detailed and intricate and complicated than we usually let people know about. So I've got some really fun stuff coming up. I do have some more videos coming out. On the Patreon right now in early access is my Xiaomi 13 Ultra versus Xperia 1 Mark V camera philosophy showdown. So you can catch that on patreon.com/somegadgetguy. I'm hoping that I'll be able to get that out public soon. I'm talking to a couple of companies. I don't know if this is going to work. I'm talking to a couple of companies right now about trying to revive the disaster prep tech idea. I wanted to make that a more regular series. But instead of it just being, oh no, California has earthquakes, here's how you charge your laptop after an earthquake, I don't want to make that video 10 times over. I'm trying to look at maybe trying to do a fun challenge video. Like, can I only use my e-bike for a week off of only solar power? Or what would it take to run my household off of an emergency battery with solar panels for like 5 days? I'm talking to a couple brands about doing something a little bit bigger. It is very difficult to do something a little bit bigger and still handle all of a household of my daughter and my wife. My wife works from home. My daughter's doing summer camps and play dates. And it's a lot to kind of put into our daily lifestyle, but I'm going to try. So that's the first heads up. You might see some things that are a little different coming to the channel soon. I really want to diversify away from the only videos that ever get traffic on my YouTube channel are only talking about smartphones that are already sort of popular for this moment in time. So there could be some really funky things coming up, but if that happens, it's because of a design and a purpose towards broadening out this conversation and finding some other fun things to talk about. So fingers crossed, I really want to stick the landing on this and I really want to do it well, because every time I go out of my way to kind of look at something new or fresh or interesting, YouTube slaps it down. There is no audience for an amazing tripod review. Not my review was amazing, but the tripod is amazing. There is no audience to looking at other alternative uses of your phones or to look at this gaming portable or to expand on your channel at all. If I make a video about a Sony, it'll get great traffic. If I talk about the Razer Edge, it just gets slapped. But then I turn around and I write an editorial on Nintendo for somegadgetguy.com, and it does more traffic in a weekend than all of my Razer Edge videos put together. So I know there are people out there that would rather talk about using this stuff rather than, here are all the giggle flips and the megapixels, and I held it in my hand, and it feels nice in the hand. And I feel like that is the death of our tech commentary, so I'm going to try and shake it up. I'm probably going to lose, but I'm not going to go down with the sinking ship without trying to bail out something. So we'll see how it goes. Folks, thank you so much for tuning in this week. I really appreciate all the chatter. This chat was fantastic. And I know because we're into that summer vacation time period. So I really appreciate those folks who are making the effort to still come on back every week to join the conversation, to join the chat, and are out there sharing and reviewing podcasts and promoting the content that they enjoy. The effort means so much to us. As we're trying to make these cool things and hopefully find folks to chat about. Because that's the fun part. It's not just making the video. It's like, oh, but that started a conversation and now people are interested in talking about this. That's what's fun. So catch you back here next week for another episode of the Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SGGQA podcast channel. I'm going to be skipping sort of the pajama podcast. This was a regular podcast. This was technically our pajama podcast week, but we've been off our routine, so we'll get back onto that routine in July. The end of July, we'll do another pajama podcast and make that, and maybe we'll do a game stream. I don't know. It could happen. So, folks, have a great week. I hope you are taking care of yourself so that you can continue to take care of others. I'll catch you back here next week for another episode of the SGGQA Monday Morning Tech Chat Show. Be safe. Take care. I'll catch you back. I love y'all.
Bye. Recording voiceover, spoken word, is truly one of my favorite activities. My second favorite hobby is photography. Now, the smartphone might be making us deaf, but we can't deny the awesome power of the phone as a platform for photography and multimedia creation. If you've been looking to improve your mobile photog skills, if you want to produce more professional content, or you're just looking to take your family photos to the next level, I wrote a book to help you out with that. Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs is available on Amazon Kindle. Walking through the basic terminology of photography, covering the settings on your camera, discussing composition and inspiration, and I even include a long list of exercises and challenges to really hone your skills, all with some helpful example photos and diagrams. Search for Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs on Amazon, or use the quick link bit.ly/betterphotosbook to grab your copy today.